Welcome to the Journey into Courage, and I'm your host, Jane Friedman, and I'm here with the gracious author and scholar, teacher, seeker, and student of life, Deborah Adele. And Deborah is here to share her experiential wisdom and passion for the often overlooked ethical practices of the Yama and Niyama as presented in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. And her book, The Yamas and Niyamas, really offers us a practical path that will and does enrich and enliven our magnificent lives with more skillful living, more awakeness and aliveness to know what matters for each of us. I'm going to begin, Deborah. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. I'm just going to read the second sentence in your acknowledgments in your book. Deepest gratitude to the sages and teachers who sit within the yogic tradition, whose selfless sharing of the richness of the yogic tradition with the West has brought a new sense of awareness, balance, and opportunity to Western consciousness. My prayer is that we in the West are worthy of the gift and can use this wisdom for the broader scope of humanity and the earth. Would you please speak about how you found the path of Yama and Niyama and your teacher or teachers?
Yes, I came to yoga quite late in my life, in my late 40s, mm-hmm. and I was really taken with a philosophy and this understanding of the compassion behind philosophy, which I think doesn't sit in our Western understanding quite as succinctly. So that there were people who actually, these great sages, these great beings who actually found something different than the rest of us know, or many of the rest of us know, and they were able to somehow come back out of their own compassion and share it. So I find for spa philosophy to be very, very compassionate and compelling in that it's so succinct. So when Patanjali, I think audaciously, says this is a science, this is the certainty of freedom, following this path will get you to this place of knowing your true essence, of this liberation, of this freedom from some of the bondage and suffering that we so often experience. Mm-hmm. There's something so compelling in that for me. So that I practice the Eightfold Path. I think that is, and that comes out of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, again, this certainty of freedom, this certainty. The same certainty as having a blueprint to build a house. This catches me. And in all of my years of study and looking at things, I never found anything that told me exactly what to do so well and why to do it. And so I gravitated to that right away. But I also, when I first read about the Yamas and Niyamas several times and had heard about them in my yoga trainings and workshops, I thought, well, I got that. I'm not violent. So I tell the truth. Let's get to the good part where I learned to put my foot behind my neck and look really cool. So that was my beginning efforts in yoga. And I owe everything, I think, at least in the beginning of this awakening in me around the Yamas and Niyamas, to Yogi Raj Achala. I happened to go to a workshop he was doing. It was a mere 3 hours, but there was something he did that made them come alive. They spoke to me. It's like, oh, something related to my own life, to a deeper relationship, a deeper kind of possibility. Yeah, kind mm-hmm. of possibility. It became more of a conversation rather than this rule that I thought I had already accomplished.
Yep. And can you give us an overview?
Of the Yamas and Niyamas?
Yeah.
Yes, I can.
So yes, you can. If anyone can, you can.
In this eightfold path that we call Ashtanga Yoga, the yamas sit first and the niyamas sit second, and then, of course, they go into asana and breath and the pieces of meditation. And I've always thought, isn't this interesting that we've overlooked it so much in the West, when one-fourth of Patanjali's plan for us is this ethical system. So there's, and it's the very first part of it. So that raises a lot of questions for me about why. Why does this begin the path of yoga? And so what's so important about an ethical system? So the yamas means restraints, if we literally translate it. And so we've got nonviolence and truthfulness, non-stealing, non-excess, and non-possessiveness. And all the nons are interesting. I realized one day when I was looking at this, because I continue to use them in my life, I continue to reflect on them, is that restraints, I started laughing at this meaning of restraints, because it's like, to me, Patanjali isn't saying, go be this awesome person, go be Gandhi or Mother Teresa or something. It's like, can you just restrain yourself from making things worse than they are? Like, can you just restrain yourself from creating disturbances in your own life, in people around you, in your families, in your communities, in the world, with your choices? And it's like a very beginning state, but it's not an easy one. And so my whole focus has been, wow, this look at where am I creating disturbance and how do I restrain myself from that? How do I pull myself back? So then the niyamas, which literally means not restraints, and so we call them observances. It's funny, but I kind of think of those as broccoli. And in relation to, I think so many of us on our spiritual paths have shifted our diet. It's just something we wanted to do from junk food to more to vegetables, so to speak. And I think of these restraints as restraining yourself from the junk food of life, restraining yourself from the junk food that sits inside of you and the candy bars, and learning to cultivate, and especially your mind, to be satisfied and to cultivate a taste for these higher ways of being, these things that begin to bring peacefulness inside of each one of us and inside and then to the world. And so practicing, cultivating a taste for purity and for contentment and self-discipline and self-study and surrender, these things can seem, I think, extremely boring in the beginning to the mind and to our lives. Because I think we're kind of addicted to chaos. But when we start to see this, it becomes this yummy nourishment for the mind and for our lives and for this continued growing of harmony within us and around us, which ripples into the world, I feel.
Yes. It's the refining.
Yes, the refining. It's always a refining, yes.
Yes. And so how do you put these precepts into practice? For example, maybe, if you want
to. I think I talk about it a lot in the book, and mm-hmm. I also then, my practice is usually to continue to take one of them a month, but sometimes something will come up in my life, and I just move to what does this particular yama or niyama say to this challenge in my life. But I have to say that I'm taking a much different, deeper look since the election,
mm-hmm.
and I have found, just in conversations with other people and kind of the atmosphere and the internal atmosphere in myself, I think that it's become awfully easy, at least for me, to look at what's happening around me, look at the people in power from my aspect, and think that I'm one of the good apples. And by that I mean, it's very easy for me to let myself off the hook right now while I'm seeing so much insanity, what I would call insanity, in choices and in policies and in thinking. And so I'm finding right now that what the yamas and niyamas are offering me in my life is this opportunity to look at my own moral weaknesses and to pull my own projections, which are so easily put outward toward a lot of people, pull them back and sit in the awareness of my own moral weakness. And that is not an easy task ever, but I think right now it isn't. And to continually remind myself that whatever is happening in the world is in me also. And I definitely am not saying not to be an activist right now, but there has to be this sense for me of this internal work that feeds the external activism and the external choices.
Right.
So I think that, I think that that's really powerful, but I also, there's another piece to that I'd like to add, and that is to be able to sit in our own moral weaknesses and not need to run from them and not need to try to fix them. And that has become extremely powerful in my own personal practice right now. The courage that it takes to just sit in it. Again, I think this is one of the biggest gifts that the East has given us, that yoga has given us, is this idea of the witness. Because I think at least what I've learned in Western culture, what I've picked up in my years, is this need to fix myself, this need to analyze, this need to try to fight myself and not do it anymore. But I think at least my experience right now in my own practice is that the healing is coming out of the courage to look at my own moral weakness and sit in that until something begins to move it. That actually is the process of healing in me and the social healing that I am longing for in our world.
And it makes me think of Thich Nhat Hanh, who's talking right now. His new book coming out is Peace in Action.
Yes, yes.
Because, like in the Tibetan Buddhist, for example, you know, it's not enough to just non-harm. It's not enough to walk around the worm on the sidewalk. You have to, that's level one. And then the next level is, okay, I'm going to pick up the worm. And I'm going to move the worm out of harm's way. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to interact and I'm going to serve. I'm going to, right? So, you know, it seems like, have you been more active? You know, we go through different phases in our lives. And as you're saying, you're engaging with the yama and niyama in a particular way that's serving your own angst or whatever. Fear,
right.
You know, recognizing. Right. But, you know, I have experienced my students and myself just completely outraged.
Yes.
You know, at first.
Yeah.
Just, it's settling. Yes. And, yes, the doors fly open and people are coming to practice more and more and more these days.
Mm-hmm.
Looking
mm-hmm.
for answers, looking for.
Yes.
And I said, just, you know, please don't react. And you're speaking to that.
Right.
Don't.
Exactly.
Don't
exactly.
Act. Settle
exactly.
down.
Go
ahead.
Well, to that point, I'd like to share an experience that I had that I think really informs where I'm coming from right now in these times of insanity, is what I would call them. When in 1988, for me, that's when we were having all of the mass killings in El Salvador, but the U.S. was supporting the government as a democracy. And there was the Contra War in Nicaragua, but people were coming across the border and talking about these cruelties and this torture of the police, really, in El Salvador. And there was something that caught my attention in that, because there was, again, that sanctuary movement in some of the churches that were giving some a place of safety. And something caught my attention, and I kept talking about it and talking about it and wondering about it. And I would talk to my friends, and finally they got so tired of me talking about it, they said, just go. So I went, and I took my brother with me, and we went through the Augsburg Global Center, which was a wonderful experience because they would give us two points of view every day. We would hear speakers on one side and speakers on the other. And it was mind-boggling to try to sort, at least for me, to sort through the truth in all of that. But it became something that became apparent through all of the hearing of both sides. And when I came back, I was young, so I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have yoga. And I reacted, I would say now in hindsight, I reacted. I was so on fire with to be against injustice. And so I took a strong 5-6 years of strong activism, and I did war protesting. I was handcuffed. I was detained. Mm-hmm. And I look back at that, and I'm amazed at my own courage, but here's the point I want to say, is that I realized after a time, and this does not happen to everyone, that I didn't like myself. Mm. All I could see was what was wrong. All I could see was wasn't working, was I was angry and disheartened and hardened, and the joy had gone out of my life. And so I pulled back from activism, and I said, I'm not going to be an activist again until I know the secret of what I called the great ones, who can work so tirelessly on behalf of the earth and the poor and the suffering and change laws and still hold on to their sense of joy and lightheartedness and love. And I just pulled back and I said, what is that? And I found that what happened to me after the election was very similar to that. And I found that around me, too, this kind of this anger, this seeing what's wrong and this being captured. I think our attention has been so captured on what is wrong and what is crazy and the choices for the environment or against the environment, I should say. So I have come to feel, again, that the most radical thing that we can do right now is to plug ourselves into Source, and that's our practice, whatever plugs us into Source, so that we're plugged into love and we're plugged into joy and we're plugged into lightheartedness. And it's out of that that we actually have the courage, have the strength, have the clarity of our own action. And so if you were to ask me what's really important right now, I'd say that's the most radical thing we could do, is to face our own moral weakness and plug into Source. And, yeah, and that's where imagination comes from, and we certainly need some creative imagination right now.
Usually so much creativity comes out, mm-hmm, as it has. Many of the other presenters are speaking about the, mm-hmm, unbelievable, mm-hmm, creativity and inspiration, and we're waking up.
Yes, we really are.
So it's
yes, we are.
It's exciting, but you know, truth, which you've been writing much about on your blog. Everybody should, I hope, will sign up for Deborah's blog. I wait with anticipation and excitement for it. We'll talk about that at the end. But you recently were talking about the second restraint, Satya, and how he doesn't say, he's not non-lying, he says truthfulness. I just want to get back to that, how the language.
Yes.
And the go all the way yama that you talk about.
Yes.
What is the difference between, you know, would you answer your own post question? What is the difference between non-lying and truthfulness?
I think it's, yeah, it's that extra, isn't it? It's what aren't you saying that needs to be said. I always call it the P.S., the P.S. I think of how often I fall into that kind of being the good yogi and the kind person, and I forget the P.S. is, well, yesterday, yes, I was angry all day, and it's the P.S. of the honesty of the human situation, I think. My answer isn't everybody's answer, and I think that's what's so profound about the yamas and niyamas, and what my wish is that everyone would write their own book, so to speak, not necessarily
yes.
literally, but these are
gotcha.
This is the book is a conversation that I took to my life, and the blogging is a conversation I'm taking currently with the administration, and that's the conversation we all need to have. I know when I go around and I have the opportunity to, I'm invited to talk about the yamas and niyamas in various places, I without doubt get many questions about so-and-so and so is happening. What do I do about it? And my response is, keep asking the question. That's a great question. And I can see their faces kind of drop. I can feel the energy in the whole room kind of drop. It's kind of this sense of we paid money for her to tell us to keep asking the question. But it's the asking of the question, like, what did Patanjali mean? Why did he say truthfulness and not lying? It's each of us asking that question of our own life in our own current situation, in the current socio-political environment, that is actually the opportunity for us to each grow into this space that we haven't yet played in yet, so to speak. It's what grows our skill in life. It's what grows our creativity. It's what grows our imagination. So I think that this continued conversation, this continued dialogue, is this amazing invitation to grow and to see.
Yes. And it's interesting how you say, you know, it's like with Satya, for example, you're like, it isn't safe, but it's good. You know, that this is
yes.
the journey into courage to take
yes.
the responsibility yes. to inquire and self-study and, you know, the,
yes.
the niyama, the last tapas,
yes.
vidya, ishvara
yes.
pranidhan, to really own and take responsibility, which is where choice, you know, I think people mm-hmm. aren't making, in general, I think the beauty of yama and niyama is like really empowering us to make the choices
yes.
that serve
yes.
Not just ourselves. It starts with
oh,
us, yes, but
yes.
outwards.
Absolutely.
To the greater.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And my husband asked me the other day, he said, I wonder what would happen if Trump and the Congress were talking about the yamas and niyamas, like if they knew that.
Well,
yeah.
I'll send you to Washington, Deborah.
Yeah.
Come on.
All political leaders, really, too. Yeah.
Yes. And, okay, I'm just going back to Satya because I'm, you know, with all this yeah. fake news and all this confusion and all this whatever, it's such a brilliant
mm-hmm.
truthfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You have a quote, I think it's C.S. Lewis from The Lion, the mm-hmm. Witch, and the Wardrobe. Is my quote-unquote yes? Because I'm speaking to the inner yes with
mm-hmm.
personal practice. It says, is my yes coming from a dark corner or from the light in my heart?
Yes.
So can you speak upon that about fear and
yes.
well, courage?
So often the dark corner is that need to be liked, to belong, to be accepted, to... It's a very selfish place. Darkness
mm-hmm.
is always a selfish place. Or is it actually coming from a desire to create harmony, to expand, to grow, to connect? Truth, I think, always leads to a greater intimacy, or at least has a potential for that. And when it comes out of darkness, it really isn't truth, and it doesn't lead to intimacy. It leads to contraction in relationships and disturbance in the world. So, again, it's where are we sourced? Where are we sourced?
Yeah, it makes me think of the practice, you know, the sort of non, to not say, for example, one of the practices is to not say, like, words, choosing your words. I mean, this is words,
yeah.
Actions, deeds, thought.
Yeah.
You know, it's is how yes. It's, right, it's the whole human dynamic, right?
Yeah.
And to not say thank you. Just try not saying thank you.
Yes.
For a couple of days.
Yes.
And see how powerful
yes.
that is. How people respond to you when they hold the door for you and you don't say thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying to go out and harm.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
But right. But in order to sort of empathy, to have more of an empathic experience. I'm just curious how you engage. I don't know if I'm being clear here, listeners, but like as practice, these, you know, just a little bit more about the yamas and niyamas. Like, for example, you said you take a month.
Yes.
Okay. So let's, you know, can you speak about, and that, yes, it is now truthfulness, but can you speak about, you know, perhaps a different month that you experienced,
okay.
perhaps recently before the election? What were you pondering?
Nonviolence. I've been spending a lot of time with nonviolence and truthfulness, and I take that moral inventory in myself constantly. Like, where's this coming from? It's silly little things like. I think the greatest practice for me with nonviolence is nobody wants to be harmed by me. So am I trustworthy? Am I a trustworthy member of the human race in every moment of the time? So when I leave the house, how am I driving? Is it impatiently? Who am I in the post office line? Are people getting my, even though there's nothing verbal, are people getting my bad vibes and my impatience? And so it's all those things. Can people trust me to not harm them? Can people even trust me to be kind? Like, ultimately, it's kindness that and so I have a thing that I've created for myself. I call it the triggers and practices.
Okay.
So with nonviolence, agitation and animosity are my two triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And agitation can be because my calendar's too full, I ate wrong, I didn't sleep well, whatever that gets me out of balance, I know I'm not trustworthy. So I'm watching for the times that I am not kind, that I am impatient, that I am not a kind driver. I watch for I'm not kind to people around me. I watch for those, and then I sit in that, and then I ask, how do I be responsible to not do that again, which, again, is that creation of the inner harmony, which takes me back to my mat practice and my cushion.
I would think you have a very extensive meditation practice to be that observant and to bear witness on that level, you know.
And to have that kind of courage and practice to be the witness of it.
Yes.
Because I think the truth of myself is pretty horrifying to me, the truth of my own weaknesses, for lack of a better, for lack of a better word, and it is that honesty. I think that frees. That's my experience, and
it's
I think, and really, there's a way that the ego gets kind of polished in this practice too, or very polished. It's definitely, I think, Patanjali's asking us to start looking at somebody beside yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a brilliant thing. especially in this culture where we are brought up to be so self-centered and narcissistic and feel entitled to so much, that the yamas and niyamas speaks to that so directly. And I think it's just mind-boggling, even to be in a store and watch a parent treat a child, like just to listen to conversations in a restaurant and to name, just begin to name what all the subtle things of nonviolence, both in ourselves and around us.
Yeah, I think that was why I was alluding to, you know, the practice of a different kind of restraint where you understand the power of, you know, one of the greatest prayers you can offer, you know, thank you, right? That's how we can really take responsibility for and understand our impact.
Yes.
And we are that powerful, each one of us.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, we are.
We are.
Oh, my gosh. That is, yes. If we could just understand that, every thought, every choice, every word.
Look how powerful. Yes. Look at the ripple of collective anxiety from one human being.
Yeah. And collective fear, yes.
Yes.
So I think it's just so radical to plug into hope and imagination and joy, because we are creating the future and the present in this moment collectively. And so how do we hold on to these precious things of goodness and joy and lightheartedness and hope?
Yes, and allow ourselves, there's a lot, you know, the guilt. There's been a lot of guilt for, for people who have had it pretty good, who have it good, who worked hard and shelter, and, you know, they're grateful, and they get to go to yoga, and they get to have a meditation practice, and, you know, all of a sudden everybody felt like everything was wrong, and the shame.
Yes.
There was all of the shame. It's like, no. Offer up. Go serve. That's how you can help. That's how you can take, you know, that peace in action.
Yes.
But don't do it out of reaction. Can you talk about tapas?
Oh, yes.
Would you?
Yeah. So self-discipline? Yes, I will. I think I really love what Ram Dass says. Said where it's this idea of heating, of actually being transformed, transmuted into something else. It is an alchemical process that we are being asked to walk into with tapas, with self-discipline. So Ram Dass says that we are not trying to be flying caterpillars. And I think he really, really says a lot in that sentence. So I had Yogi Raj Achua used to say, you've got to remember that every workshop you're going to, every book you're reading on spirituality and your practice and everything you're learning, your ego's right there learning it with you. So it's just learning to be a smarter spiritual ego. And I think that's what Ram Dass is saying, that there is a piece of us that we have to be aware of that is our ego, who is reading all these books, trying to figure out how to fly without going into the cocoon, like anything to look spiritual. And so remembering that it's this literal willingness to step into being changed.
The fire,
Everything that the ego doesn't want. It wants control. It wants security. It wants to be liked and belong. And this is, I literally have the image of stepping, of getting into a frying pan or getting into a cocoon. And I can hear my ego go, no, I don't think so. Let's just fly without it. So along those lines, what I have found, because I've had the opportunity to travel some third world countries, is that I'm so aware of how easy it is to escape my practice.
This when things get,
yes, exactly. And I can shelter myself from the weather, from insects, from, I can have what I want to eat when I want to, any kind of tea. When I travel third world countries, that's not available. And so what I have, what I realize is how easy it is when life gets a little bit tough, or to sit on my cushy cushion to do my practice, how easy it is to think I've done my practice, or now it's okay to watch a movie. I'm kind of done. I'm kind of done for the day. The challenge is too hard. So tapas for me is when things feel really challenging, both externally and in my own personal life, in the world, how can I stay in it? That's the fire for me. How can I just stay there and not go put a movie on? Yeah, go escape it. So the story of the Devi Mahatmya is the story that holds up this image of practice for me. Are you familiar with that? The Devi Mahatmya? There's a, may I just share a little piece of it?
Yes.
It's basically, it's interesting because it's so much, feels similar to today's time, but two evil rulers have taken over a kingdom, and they are very bad, and so that there's toxins in the air, and there's all this kind of, there's this destruction of the earth and of people, and there's suffering and hopelessness, and so the people go to the Ganges River, and they pray for deliverance, and out comes the great Devi. And she says, I will do battle for you. So she goes to battle against Shumba and Nishumbara, these two evil kings who have taken over. And it's a bloody long war. It reads like any great epic like Battlestar Galactica or anything, The Hobbits. It just goes on and on and on. And evil is always throwing all these trick things at him and these massive surprises. But the Devi, she's just steady. And at one point, Shumba and Nishumba send this horrible warrior who, when the Devi slays him, every drop of blood goes to the ground, and it just becomes another warrior as evil as he is. And so pretty soon there's hundreds of thousands of these warriors all over. And what is interesting to me is at that point, the Devi doesn't go. She doesn't go, this is too much. I think I'm going to watch a movie. She digs inside of herself for something she didn't know she had, and she pulls out Kali, who has the long tongue, who licks up the drops of blood before they drop, and pretty soon everything is destroyed and all the warriors are gone. But it's this drawing in and creating something, drawing something out of oneself they didn't know they had. And that, to me, is the beauty of the practice, this steadiness of the practice. And in the end, Shumba and Nishumba are, they're destroyed, and the rightful ruler is brought back, and the earth is restored to beauty and goodness. But the allegory is, I think, so appropriate for our times, in that Shumba and Nishumba, the throne is our heart, the kingdom, this internal spiritual allegory, that our hearts have been overtaken by our own egos and their attachments, which brings all the greed and fear and et cetera. And that's what's causing destruction in our own lives and in the world. And so the Devi comes up and she fights, and then our soul or the divine is restored back as the rightful ruler of our hearts. But the really cool thing for me is the Devi represents our practice. It's our practice that takes the ego and the greed and the fear and all of that off of the heart where they don't belong, and restores this divine source to the heart. And the steadiness of the practice, the steady, 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 steady. It's not the spurts. It's not the surprise attacks. It's the steadiness. So that's what I would say about tapas. It's this drawing out this, what we didn't even know we had. And that's what these times are calling us to. Draw out what we didn't even, stay in the game and draw out what we didn't even know we had. And we need each other to do that. This is a collective, a collective thing we're doing for sure. Yes. We need to be in our yoga communities and our other like-minded communities gaining strength from each other, doing our practice together.
Connecting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Connecting.
Yes.
Connecting.
Very
imagining
important.
Together.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to vulnerability? A huge part of courage.
A huge part of courage.
Or is it just the same as fear? And when you're fear, you're vulnerable, you're in the unknown, and we've covered that. Mm. We don't need to deconstruct fear.
I think you said something really important. And I think I'm just going to take it back to the yamas and niyamas.
Yep.
To say that, to be willing to sit in the not knowing of what nonviolence really is, or what truthfulness really is, to be willing to not know, that is a vulnerability to the conversation of the yamas and niyamas and to life right now, like what is right action right now, to be willing to not know, but to be willing to, as Gandhi said, be humbler than a speck of dust in our seeking. I think of Bonhoeffer with that conversation he had where he was such a strong pacifist and ended up being part of an assassination attempt on Hitler, which failed. I mean, that is a conversation with nonviolence. And I'm not saying we should all become future assassins, but there is something there compelling to me in the conversation. He was vulnerable. He was vulnerable to what nonviolence meant in the context of his time, Hitler's Germany, and as he saw what was happening. That's vulnerable to me, is not knowing exactly what the right policies are right now, but being willing to engage with a lot of people of opposite views, with a lot of people of same views, to stoke the imagination. And again, imagination and creativity cannot happen out of fear. So how do we enliven ourselves with, I think, nature and with our cushion? And there is a Gandhi, I just keep going back to Gandhi saying we have to be humbler than a speck of dust, that is what vulnerability is.
Mm-hmm. To trust, to
mm-hmm.
keep building the trust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do think, you know, asana is wonderful for that, to build,
yes.
to go from the gross body into the subtle body and build the integrity and the strength
mm-hmm.
and the openness,
mm-hmm.
you know, to stand in that not knowing
yes.
Fully, you know,
yes.
all your senses. That's great. Oh, okay, Deborah. So tell us, you know, as you say, we cannot do this alone. The teacher is, and has been, I know for me, many teachers, but one particular I have been blessed with here. Can you tell us how you work with people? Aside from your fabulous book, which gives people the key to the door, you know, but, you know, your online work and privately and kind of what you're doing right now with your business, integrating yama and niyama into businesses, I believe.
Yes.
Can I tell us?
Yes.
Hmm. Yeah.
I am mostly going where I'm invited right now, which is a very interesting thing for me. It's an experiment I'm doing of not seeking anything, but of responding to what is being asked. And so I have a lot of invitations now from mostly studios, a couple of prisons and other organizations, churches, to speak on the yamas and niyamas. And I find that very potent right now, the discussions that are coming out, that people are asking, the conversations that are happening. And that is my work right now. In May, I'm actually going to go on sabbatical through December, and I think there's another book that's going to happen, but my main thing is to steep myself in my personal practice, like really engage in that and be renewed I'm feeling that call, so I'm answering that. So a lot of the things that you talked about, I will continue to blog because I want to be blogging on the yamas and niyamas this year and my own, again, my own inquiry as is coming out of the political environment. But, yeah, I'm going into some cloistered off time of practice. That's where my heart is very clearly being asked to go. So.
Okay. All right. but wait, you just had a great program on Yoga International.
Oh, I did. Yes, I did.
Are you going to run that again? Are they going to run that again?
I think it's still there. I think it is free to members.
Okay. Good. And you have so many articles, amazing articles, and at that site as well, offered by Yoga International, Interview Yoga Magazine.
Yes.
Okay.
I will keep updating those with other writings also from other people that are writing pertinent things, and I've tried to put that in the blog too. Some of the hooking us into some of the other people doing some pretty amazing things.
Yes, you do offer that at the bottom, and you've got wonderful live interviews, just so people can have more of you. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I want people to go out and interact with the yamas and niyamas, exploring yoga's ethical practice, written by Deborah. It really is a lovely invitation to more skillful living. It's a practice, and it can be, these teachings can be infused with some tapas, with some effort and inquiry.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Jane. Oh, well, thank you so much for being here and sharing your path of practice with us today. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful insight. Okay. Bye, everybody. Thank you, Deborah.